Mars del Corp. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Larson, Judge Reyes, Judge Bratfold, the Honorable Elise L. Larson presiding.
Morning, everyone, and welcome to the Court of Appeals for the audio record. Today is December 10th, 2024, and this hearing is being held by Zoom.gov for the audio record. Today's hearing will be available on the court's website. We will have three cases for oral argument today. I would observe to the attorneys that you should be able to see the time clock if you have your screen in gallery view. And I'd just like to, before we start, verify that you can all see the marshal's screen. I see head shakes from both parties, so that's great. And with that, I will call the first case, which is A24-0348, State of Minnesota v. Udazy. Please correct me if I mispronounced that. Good morning to both counsel.
Good morning.
As I'm sure you both know, you will be each given 15 minutes for your argument this morning, and appellant, you will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. As I said, we're creating an audio record, so before beginning your argument, if you could please identify yourself and your client for the record, that would be much appreciated. With that, counsel for appellant, you may begin when you are ready.
Yes, good morning. May it please the court, opposing counsel. My name is Attorney Jacob Burkholz, and I represent the appellant, Iniwu Daniel Udazy. And we have three issues before the court. I'll start with what I believe to be our strongest issue, although I think issues one and two are both are all good for the court. Number one, that the juror was biased in this case and therefore constitutes structural bias and should be subject to automatic reversal. And I think what's telling, and I want to point the court to one case, is actually it's unpublished case, State versus Bergendahl, not cited. I know the state had its own unpublished case. I think it's a fairly helpful case. The Court of Appeals reversed. It's unpublished, citing it as A19-1450. I actually was the trial judge. It was trial attorney, and in that matter, and I handled Mr. Bergendahl's case and the trial. But the essential part of that Court of Appeals case, as it relates to juror bias, is that they reversed. First issue is whether or not the juror could express unequivocalness, and the juror could not. And I think the record's very clear. Now, where it becomes a little more interesting is that what's the basis? And there appears to be no case law, so I suppose we're asking for a published decision in this case. There's no case law that expresses. So under Rule 26, the two factors to assess whether a juror expressed actual bias. And as the state points out as well, there's those two bases. One is state of mind. And in that, so I'm not sure where this exactly fits, because the juror says very clearly, lost in the family, very strong emotions related to that situation, couldn't track along, and was very concerned that could not be fair and impartial. The Bergendahl case, admittedly, that juror had some relation to prior abuse in the family, and therefore whether or not the Munt and Fraga cases don't seem to outline where the source of the strong and deep impressions come from. And I don't think that case law necessarily dictates that the source of the strong and deep impressions that impact the juror's ability to be fair have to come from circumstances related to the context of the case. And I think that's perhaps the state's defense to that argument, is that, well, it relates only to family situations that aren't related directly to the impressions in the case. And I think Bergendahl's and cases like it, where you have a sexual offense and the juror expresses doubt related to family experience, is a very clear case. This is less clear, but certainly the outcome of the statements of the juror are no less clear, meaning that the
Mr. Burkholz, if I could, yes. I want to ask you a little bit about the standard for actual bias that you're referring to. So as I understand it, it's a strong and deep impression, and I'm quoting from the Fraga opinion, that would prevent the juror from laying aside her impression or opinion and rendering a verdict based on the evidence presented in the court. Is that roughly a definition of actionable bias? I hear you kind of at least adopting parts of that in your argument. Is that a definition you'd like us to look at and consider?
Yeah, and the controlling case law is Front and MAGA.
Okay, and then I guess what I want you to do is apply that, if you would, to the record that we have in this case to demonstrate actual bias. I hear you talking about the strong and deep impression or feelings, and I can definitely see that in the juror five's remarks. But the part about laying aside her impressions or opinions, that's where I'm struggling. So would you address that, please? Thank you.
Yes, Your Honor. I think and that is, I suppose, a challenge to say, what's your impression? So is there a specific impression? I can't point to a specific impression other than to say the juror could not maintain a mental focus to provide a fair and unbiased review of the record of the trial.
So that's the part I don't see in the record. Would you help me out where you see that in the transcript of the voir dire transcript? I certainly see the part about having difficulty concentrating. Mm-hmm. I don't see where the juror explains that creates an impression or opinion that the juror is unable to set aside and be fair.
And sure. Impact.
Yeah.
Transcript pages, for example, 54 and 55. The juror is questioned by defense counsel and saying, "Your mind is wandering and not knowing if you'll be able to focus due to your circumstances." And so I think perhaps the impression is the impression that they're focused on grief, and that focus on the grief would impact their ability to be fair. I would hope not. The answer is from juror. I would hope not, but yes, it's possible.
Seems to me you're in making that inference, and I'm even struggling to see where you made that argument to the district court. You're making that inference to us today. I appreciate that and asking us to reach that conclusion based on the transcript. But help me out. You know, do you see that argument presented to the district court?
There isn't a lot of discussion with the district court. I wasn't the trial counsel in this case, so I can't elaborate more fully. But I would say that there was a good discussion by defense counsel that says you're overwhelmed. And the juror's answer on page 57 says you get overwhelmed with grief, and it's just like your mind stops thinking. So is the deep impression about the case? And I don't think that's necessary. I think that is certainly a clear part of case law, but I think case law, to the extent it's not clear, should be extended for circumstances such as this. So if the standard of Fraga and Munt are restrained or constrained, then I'd ask that this court extend the strong and deep impression to have a strong and deep opinion that would remove the juror's focus to the case, where the juror can no longer be fair and impartial. I think the key piece is that the juror cannot be fair and impartial and is not rehabilitated and has a strong and deep opinion about the source of where it comes from. And I appreciate the court identifying that there isn't that clear link, and that there appears to be the only clear link is that there's a strong and deep impression about the case. I don't find that in case law. I do think that's a very clear connection, and such as cases like Bergendahl and others where you're not fair to the underlying facts, sensitive to murder trial issues, sensitive to criminal sexual conduct or to abuse cases. But I don't think that it should be limited. Alternatively, and I think the alternative under Rule 26 is that if the juror is such a physical or mental condition, so the court doesn't like to deal with that actual bias piece under, I think it's 0.01 and then 0.05, I believe, in Rule 26, is that in fact the juror has to be suffering under some sort of physical or mental condition that would make them lack of fair and impartiality. And I do think that is an option for this court to say. And there is, I couldn't find great case law to say, what does that mean? Well, what does that mean from a juror who is clearly expressing their inability to be fair and impartial?
I'm having trouble unmuting myself. Mr. Burkholz, before you explore the legal standard for physical and mental condition, that's another one where I don't see that raised to the district court. Another point that you're making today that I don't see raised to the district court. So do you have examples where we have looked at a new ground, under Rule 26, obviously, for concluding that a juror is not impartial and, you know, as you that created structural error, you know, new ground raised for the first time on appeal.
I don't know if that was a two-part question, whether or not was it adequately raised in the district court?
I mean, I didn't see it raised at all in district court. Did I miss it? Physical?
Well, I think the only standard that I understand to preserve the issue for appeal is whether or not the juror was challenged and that discussion occurred to the district court. That was made, that was challenged. The juror was challenged. The state attempted rehabilitation. Was there a good discussion on case law? No, there was not to the district court.
So I guess I understood, and maybe I have a misimpression, that your challenge was based on the challenge in district court was based on actual bias, not on physical or mental condition. Am I assuming that in error?
Again, not being the trial court attorney, I don't think that was.
Well, you're like me, though. You read the transcript, right?
Yeah. I don't see it clearly differentiated whether or not it was a physical limitation or whether it was only based on bias. I do think that the record focuses on bias, and I think that's typical for attorneys, that they focus on the juror's inability to be fair, but it was not ferreted out either by the trial court or the state or the defense as to the basis for that argument. And I think it'd be hard to imagine, perhaps like maybe in a murder trial where you get a week long of voir dire to really flesh that out, but this is a misdemeanor, a gross misdemeanor assault case, and it certainly seemed to be the trial judge was pushing this case along in great fashion. And so it's hard to imagine that there maybe would have been indulged, and maybe defense counsel should have pushed back to the trial judge and really vetted that issue out for the juror at the time. But I do think it is raised sufficiently for this court to review on appeal. But as to flush out the issue of physical and mental limitation, I could not find specific case law or an expansion of the grounds of that. But I do think that the juror's statements, the juror was not rehabilitated. The juror did not make any unequivocal statements that they could be fair. And I do think that other than a physical disability, which I think would be, we try to ameliorate with, headphones and hearing. What other circumstance? So, for example, that great sense of depression and that great sense of grief and loss where a juror becomes so unable to focus, and then they voluntarily disclose that to the court, should give this court great pause that this juror was giving great attention and knew under repeated questioning that they would be unable or could not at least clearly say they could be fair and impartial. But I see.
Mr. Burkholz, I just want to follow up quickly on that. On the transcript on page 56 to 57, there is a colloquy between the district court and the juror in which the district court asks the juror if she could pay attention over the course of the next couple of days and be fair and impartial. Would you try to do that? And she says, I would. And that does seem to be different than the case law that you cite in terms of equivocal responses with respect to rehabilitation. And then prosecutor asks, have you been able to pay attention thus far today? And she says, yeah. Why is that not an unequivocal statement compared to case law in which equivocal statements have been made?
And I think, I don't think this was flushed out thoroughly, because I think the court, and as is typical, saying, you'll try. And I don't think try is sufficient. It's like Reese v. State, 889 Northwest 2nd, 308. Prospective juror is not rehabilitated if they say they'll merely try, merely do their best, or think they could, or think that it would be hard, but they could try to do so. And so that equivocal nature of the answer, I mean, what is a juror supposed to say to a judge when you have the backdrop of all that? Jurors are going to say, well, I'm going to try. I'm going to try to do my best. But the backdrop for that, I think the answer always has to be, the trial court cannot engage in what I'll call and invite the error. And the error is invited when trial judges say, well, you'll try, won't you? You'll just try. And that's very frequently response by trial judges because they think that's the law. They think that the law is that if you try, it's good enough. And if you can tell me you can try, it's good enough. But my review of the case law is when you've already said you know you can't be fair, and then they invite it answer by, yes, you'll try, or you'll do your best. And I think this court should not tolerate answers that say you'll try or do your best, because then that will be the response from every state attorney and every trial judge. It doesn't matter how biased they are. Almost every juror I've ever had or seen says, we'll try to set aside my bias. I'll try and set aside on my feelings when they've already expressed that they can't. And the answer then in case law is it has to be unequivocal. You can't say, and that's where the trial judge doesn't follow up and neither does the state to make sure that it's unequivocal. And I think the defense attorney does a good job by making that clear that it is equivocal and that equivocal response is clear in the record. And I think, unfortunately, that's what we're left with. We're left with an equivocal record. And this court should reverse. I see I only have 5 seconds and I missed my other 2 points. So I'll do my best to reach those in my response.
Thank you, counsel. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondents, you may begin when you're ready.
May it please the court. Counsel, my name is Juliana Passy. I'm an assistant Lyon County attorney representing the respondent, state of Minnesota. I'm jumping into the juror issue. The state strongly believes that this is not a case of bias and that the Mundt and Fraga standards are not met in this case. There was no opinion expressed by the juror five in this case, relating to any opinion that she had as to the facts of the case, any opinion as to the subject matter of the criminal case, any bias toward any knowledge of the parties or anything. So the state believes that this is not a case of bias. I think that's, if the defense, I think the only possible ground that the defense brought up below that the district court was considering was potentially bias. And I draw that only from the fact that the defense attorney referenced Fraga, which is obviously a bias case, in some of her comments, and then said that it would be clearly reversible structural error issue if she's going to leave the juror on so that it can be reversed on appeal potentially. I think that's the only basis that was presented to the district court is for striking the juror, and this is just not that case. That there is any impression or opinion expressed by juror five regarding the verdicts, it's all about her internal ability to concentrate, which is not an issue of bias. Like Mr. Burkholz, I didn't find a lot of case law that was similar to this kind of case, but the Weirson case that I cited in my brief, which is an unpublished case from this court from 2019, was the absolute closest I could find. In that case, the defendant, I think it was a pro se argument, at the end of a brief, where the appellant claimed that a juror expressed bias by saying his concentration wasn't all that great and there was a lot of the stuff about the trial was over his head. That's the only case I could find in the Minnesota appellate case law regarding a contention that an inability to concentrate constituted bias. This court, in that opinion, said that none of the comments of the juror showed that he exhibited strong and deep impressions that would prevent him from putting aside those impressions, and that no comments expressed any reflected opinion of any kind. I think that's exactly where we are in this case. The juror expressed concerns about her ability to concentrate and said that maybe she's going to be overwhelmed by grief potentially, perhaps during trial, but she hasn't had any problems so far in concentrating. So I think this is not a case of bias, and I think that the court should move on quickly from that analysis. The more interesting ground, I think,
counsel,
is the...
I have one question about this. So just as a hypothetical, let's say that we had a juror come in who definitely was struggling for concentration. The district court can see it, everybody can see it. What would be the correct ground under Rule 26 to analyze that? Or are you saying there isn't a ground under Rule 26 for the court to analyze that issue of concentration?
I think the correct issue would be the mental or physical disability. I think that's the closest that the rule comes to, because it isn't an issue of bias. If anything, this juror is not mentally in a place today to try this or to hear this case. They won't be able to pay attention to what's going on. Of course, that's important in a trial. I think that's the ground. There isn't a lot of case law at all that I could find. I looked Minnesota courts and I looked as much federal as I could. And there's not a lot of case law on that either. I think that is the ground, but I think that places us outside of all of the bias case law, the structural error case law, and I think brings us to first of all, this ground I think was pretty clearly not raised to the district court. The defense attorney in this case had a large number of opportunities to make a further record on issues that the defense counsel disagreed with the district court's decisions on. And in fact, she did make significant record in various places, particularly regarding the issue number two with the video. I think there was the opportunity for this to be raised, even if it wasn't in that moment before, in the whispered bench conference, there was opportunity for the defense counsel to raise the issue and say, actually, judge, to be clear, my case, I'm saying bias and I'm saying mental or physical disability. They didn't do that in this case. So the district court, I don't think, wasn't a place to make a ruling on that. But even if they were, I think that's a factual determination that this court looks at for clear error. Was this juror, in fact, not in a place to be able to sit on the jury this day? And I think that's something that, with all the case law that this court has about deference to the district court, when the district court is the one seeing the juror in front of them, they're the one, seeing what they're looking like when they're listening to questions. I think that there is no clear error in the district court's implied determination that this juror was okay to sit for trial this day. That the prosecutor did ask and say that, yes, I've had the ability to pay attention so far in the case. I would also note that no one, the district court, prosecutor, defendant, defense counsel, indicated any concerns, or the juror herself indicate concerns during the trial that she's been overwhelmed, she can't pay attention to what's going on. So I think this is a case where there's no clear error in the factual determination. I don't think there's any basis for the structural bias or the structural error issue is confined, from my review of appellate case law, to the issue of actual bias. That's where this court has, the Minnesota appellate courts have expanded it to structural error. Otherwise, it's applying this showing of prejudice that originates in the Stufflebean case from the 80s. But this court has still applied that to issues of, allegedly the juror isn't not a resident of the county. They shouldn't have been sitting on the jury because they weren't a resident of the county. Well, what's your prejudice, defendant? In this case, there's no prejudice to the defense because they can't show that the juror wasn't paying attention. There was no concerns raised at trial. And this discussion all happened before strikes were happening. So the defense certainly had the opportunity to strike the juror and they didn't. So I think the juror bias issue is, or the juror issue, I think, is a non-issue. And I think the court should quickly dispose of that. I'm going to move on to the next issue that Mr. Burkholz raised, which was the admission of that longer video. Of course, this is a clear abuse of discretion standard for the court. And I think there's no clear abuse of discretion in this particular case. Particularly,
counsel, I have one sort of factual question with respect to the skips in the video.
Mm-hmm.
Were the arguments that the skips occurred only you know, in the right, there's the beginning and then there's the end, right? There's the new images at the beginning and new images at the end.
Right.
Are that these skips only occurred in the new parts of the video at the end, or were there also arguments about there being skips at the 30 seconds or whatever it is at the beginning of the video?
As I recall, there are no arguments about skips in the beginning. There were some arguments early on.
I didn't see any skips in the beginning of the video, and that's why I wanted to make sure that I understood where we're arguing where these skips are occurring.
Yeah, I believe it's in the end of the new portion of the video. And then there's one skip in the existing 1 minute and 11 seconds video that everyone was operating under until the middle of the second day of trial. I think that, and that was litigated when Mr. Udesi was pro se, that was litigated in the first contested omnibus hearing. He was arguing that this was a manipulated video based on, in part, on the skips, and the district court reviewed and held that it was admissible. In this case, the district court was well within its discretion in excluding that longer video. The defense had a large amount of opportunities to introduce evidence regarding the victim's alleged aggressive behaviors and prior incidents between her and Mr. Udesi. The state would note that the district court did allow three of those witnesses to testify over the state's objection remotely from Nigeria during the trial. So that's an extreme, fairly extreme. I haven't seen that happen before. So that's a pretty significant help to the defense in presenting its case. Mr. Udesi, of course, testified regarding all of this. You know, she was holding onto my shirt before the video that was presented at trial happened. And I would also note that the witness KO testified not only in reviewing for this argument. I noted that I was reading the contested omnibus transcripts. He testified at both contested omnibuses. At the second contested omnibus, he testified that defense counsel asked him to say what had he observed in that video that when at that time he said he only got this short section of the video. He said she asked him to describe everything he'd seen, and he did the best he could. And he says, it's really vague. I don't really remember too much, but I'll tell you what I can remember. At trial, he gave a very in-depth description of what that longer video showed. The state would note that this was after he had recovered the video, so perhaps he'd had the opportunity to review the whole video. But if you compare his trial testimony with what happens in the excluded video, it's very, he's describing everything that happens in that video that perhaps he had just watched. So I think that there is any error, there is no error in excluding it because of the amount of evidence that the defense was allowed to introduce regarding her self-defense defense, the very lateness of the disclosure, the state and the district court both
If I may, counsel, I just want to follow up on a point that I'm hearing you argue, and I hadn't noticed it or thought about it before, so I just want to make sure I understand it. Sounds like you're talking about KO's testimony at trial conveying a fairly detailed account. And he's remote, you know, at the time of the incident, he is remotely viewing what's happening, right? And then he's recounting it, which I appreciated he did that. But it seems like you're implying that perhaps he refreshed his recollection between the time of the pretrial hearings and the trial, and that's why his account at trial is so detailed. Is that a point that got explored on the record, counsel? And I just missed that.
Your Honor, he certainly indicate, or the record indicates that he reported to defense counsel, you know, she says he just told me that he was reviewing his account, and he actually found the full video. So I think there's indication there that I presume found the whole video. In order to find the whole video, you have to know that it's not the existing video, right? So I think that's there. I think it was a little bit delved into in when he was examined at trial, but I don't know if any details. So perhaps that's a little bit of a, and perhaps I think we're straying a little bit from the point. I think the point is he testified at trial at length about what the whole video showed. And so I think that negates any claim that there was that Mr. Udesi was not able to present a fair defense at trial. Obviously, this is exceptionally late disclosure. The state and the district court both expressed concerns regarding the veracity of KO in regard to the fact that he had testified under oath at two separate contested omnibus hearings, that he had, this video that everyone had was the whole video that he'd had. He had watched more of the incident, but this was only the part that he was able to grab. And then he deleted everything else because he didn't want to be involved. That's what his testimony was twice. He it's true he was subpoenaed by the state. The state didn't call him. And then, you know, the state has rested. And then he, midday, second day of trial, he comes up apparently to the defense counsel and says, oh, I've got this whole video. Obviously, the state wasn't able to show it to any of its witnesses, didn't know it existed. And I think any argument that there's an abuse of discretion by the district court in these circumstances that's just not the case. I also think, again, everything that happened after, the state's charges were clearly based on the video. The complaint itself refers to the video. The victim at trial says that the incident ended when the video ended. That was the end of the incident. And of course, the video she's referring to was that shorter video that everyone was operating under at the time. So the state's charges are only based on the smaller video. Anything that happens after that is not relevant. I think that's particularly true. In this case, the only claim we're talking about is the domestic violence count, right? Because the jury acquitted on the issue of the false imprisonment count. So I think there is no abuse of discretion in the case under these facts. And even if it's harmless error, because there was a very strong case for the state in this case. He is shown on video punching her in the face or head about 10 times is what I counted. So the state believes there's no abuse of discretion. I see I'm just about out of time. So thank you. The state would ask that the court affirm.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. Just want to end on, since we spent almost the entire time on the juror question, I had to think about what way perhaps legally to think about it. I find the dissent is fairly persuasive in State versus Munt, in that this might be better phrased as an argument, whether or not there's that structural integrity of the entire trial process under the U.S. and Minnesota Constitution that goes to, as noted in the first kind of paragraphs of the dissent, that this is whether the juror had a biased state of mind rather than focusing on the opinions therefrom, so that the case can't be tried with impartiality or without prejudice. And that the dissent does reference 2602 sub 5-1. Again, if this court wants to find it under the mental framework, it so can do so. But I think in either sense, this wasn't a fair juror to sit on the trial. Then I'll move on to my other two issues to make sure they get discussed at least a little bit. This video, I think the issue for error and the issue why this court should reverse on number two on the video is whether or not the self-defense argument would be impacted by the defense on the video. First, from my review of the record and understanding is that this wasn't something that the trial, it was a clear abuse of discretion to wholly prohibit a video that shows up from what I can see as a surprise. This isn't anything blamed on the defense or defense attorney or defendant that this King Ona KO somehow comes up with it, but no one knows how or why. That's not fleshed out. The trial court doesn't make a record of that and doesn't and shouldn't then punish the defense when that video has some value, and I think significant value. And I do agree that the skip comes in only between that, it's the middle video. We have the initial 34 seconds, minute 11, and then the 3 minutes after. So there's a little skip there, but it's still right in time. Was it edited or not? Either way, that first part of the video also provides significant context, and it provides nothing's better than video. And pictures worth 1,000 words, and then we'd have thousands of images. And so we'd have substantial evidence for the jury to review and putting into context and in light. Just because,
Counsel, I wanted to ask a question about that because, you know, the district court said the latter part of the video really doesn't matter. It's what occurred beforehand. So to the extent that it is relevant, it would just be that that first part, which is different than the original 1 minute plus video. But one issue that the district court did mention is confusion to the jury. And I have to admit, when I watched the first video and then I went to watch the second video, I was a little confused as to what exactly are the differences between the two. And I almost felt like I had to like go back and forth and try to compare and contrast. Why is the district court's reliance on confusion as one of the factors? Why is that error or an abuse of discretion?
And I do think the underlying position of the trial court that this trial was taking too long and needed to get done in 2 days, it's prejudice to the defense. And there shouldn't be any rush to try a case. And even if there is evidence that comes in, the trial court's, I think she's using what I'll call bootstrap logic, which is that the only confusion is the failure to attempt to clarify. So you can, a trial court shouldn't then say, well, I'm not going to allow videos that I'm not even going to allow in, that she won't, what I can tell, doesn't review, doesn't allow any witnesses to testify outside of the jury, the defendant or subpoenaed state witnesses to clarify anything, and just says it's confusing. Why is it confusing? If there's no record as to the basis for the confusion, then it's simply the trial court's unwillingness to allow additional time to flush out a video that comes in mid-trial. So again, the trial court says, well, if I think it's confusing, well, then I'm not going to allow it to come in. And again, no real clarity. That's why we have to do motions and post-trial motions. And the trial court is just unwilling to give any other time and attention to the case. And perhaps the state's argument is right. Well, I think there's enough evidence in the case. And that's the infringement on the jury trial process, where the trial court then in her post-trial memorandums then comes in and attempts to weigh all the evidence and weigh the strength of the defendant's case and weigh the strengths of the testimony. Well, that's exactly what trial courts are not supposed to do in the jury trial process. And I think that is very concerning here. And you can see that logic in the post-trial motions. Thank you. I'm out of time.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsel in this case. The case has been submitted.